Drive into your nearby Supermarket station, and there you will be welcomed by signs talking about Supermom. And the assumption is that Supermom stops there, driving home from her super job in her super car, to pick up some super snacks for her super kids who are part of her super family back at her super house. And we need to understand that Supermom is not just a creation of the advertising people of the Ashland Oil Company, but actually is something that many modern women aspire to be, seeking to skillfully and successfully balance career and marriage, family, and personal life, and finding that the challenge is a super challenge, a very great challenge, to seek to balance all of these and to do it well. Nowhere is Supermom better described than in the last chapter, the last page of the Old Testament book of Proverbs. And so I invite you to a somewhat familiar section of Scripture, reading with some comment from Proverbs 31, verse 12, to the conclusion of that book. We see in verse 12 that she brings her husband good, not harm, all the days of his life, which makes it sound like she never makes a mistake, which is a very nice quality for a wife to have. And in verse 13, she selects wool and flax and works with eager hands, so she is a very hard worker. In verse 14, she is like the merchant ships, bringing her food from afar. So it seems that she doesn't shop at Supermarket after all. It seems that she buys her meat at the butcher shop, and she gets her baked goods at the bakery, and her vegetables at the market, and uses no preservatives. That's not mentioned, but that's sort of assumed between the lines. Verse 15 explains that she gets up while it is still dark. She provides food for her family and portions for her servant girls. So Supermom is also a very early riser. She's up at dawn, actually before that, in order to cook the meal. She has servant girls, which is nice also. But that doesn't make her lazy. In fact, she cooks the meal for the servant girls. So she is somewhat like the woman who makes sure that the house is thoroughly clean before the cleaning lady arrives, so that the cleaning lady has a nice clean house to work in. In verse 16, she considers a field and buys it. And she does this so that out of her earnings, she plants a vineyard. So she has a real estate license. She buys and sells property, and she's good at it. She turns over a profit, she reinvests, and she diversifies. She's into vineyards as well. In verse 17, she sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her tasks. So we see yet again that she is a very hard worker, and she's somewhat muscular. She's in good shape, not because she goes to the health club, but because she works very, very hard. In verse 18, she sees that her trading is profitable and her lamp does not go out at night. Now, she's starting to sound a little bit like a workaholic because she's up before dawn and she doesn't put her light out at night. In verse 19, in her hand she holds the distaff and grasps the spindle with her fingers. Understand that we're talking here about a description of a woman in ancient Hebrew culture. And some of the things that have been described are not fitting to the traditional role of a woman. So she is doing things that customarily would only have been done by men in her society. However, according to verse 19, she has maintained her responsibilities and fulfilled them well in the traditional role of spinning and other chores that a woman normally would have done in that society. In verse 20, she opens her arms to the poor and extends her hands to the needy. So not only does she succeed at home and in the marketplace, but also so she has compassion and she has time for those who are needy. She is active, she is an advocate and a helper of the poor. In verses 21 and 22, when it snows, she has no fear for her household, for all of them are clothed in scarlet. She makes coverings for her bed. She is clothed in fine linen and purple. So everything at home is well. The storms, in this case a snowstorm, may rage on the outside, but everything is fine in the inside. She is such a marvelous homemaker that she sews the clothes for her family, she makes the bedspreads, and her house is featured in Country Living magazine. In verse 23, we are told that her husband is respected at the city gate, where he takes his seat among the elders of the land. So do not think that this astounding woman overshadows her husband, for he is a person of significant fame and power and stature within his own community as well. He is a member of the city council, and he is highly regarded. In verse 24, she makes linen garments and sells them, and supplies the merchants with sashes. So it seems that she has a great deal of free time and excess energy. And with that, since her land deals and vineyards seem to be going very well, and everything is humming along smoothly at home, she has started yet another business on the side, and she is manufacturing clothes, and she is shipping them out and selling them around the world. In verse 25, she is clothed with strength and dignity. She can laugh at the days to come. So it's not just what she does, but it is also a matter of who she is. She is a together woman, so much so that she has such a healthy perspective on life that she may look to the future with all of its uncertainties and threats, and she can laugh at them. She is that secure. She has that much confidence. In verse 26, she speaks with wisdom, and faithful instruction is on her tongue. Perhaps that refers to the seminars that she gives on being a together woman. She's so good at it that she's now teaching other people how to do it as well. In verse 27, she watches over the affairs of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Not that there was any doubt that she was lazy, but here it is being clearly stated that she's completely in control and she never loafs. Verse 28, her children arise and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. So this seemingly perfect woman is adored by her children. She is praised by her husband. They all think that she is absolutely great, and they tell her as well as appropriately they should. In verse 29, many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. So in case you haven't already guessed, she's number one. She is the best there is. There may be a lot of other women, including people you know, who are very good, but they don't measure up to her. She is the best. In verse 30, charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting. But a woman, and I think yet specifically this woman, who fears the Lord is to be praised. So there's a lot more to her than good looks, although she is good looking, which is nice as well. And she has great charm, but she has depth of person. And who she is inside is even more beautiful than who she is on the outside. Verse 31, give her the reward that she has earned, and let her works bring her praise at the city gate, because she deserves it. She does. She is an amazing, amazing person. Now, I skipped over the beginning of this description back in verse 10, which seems to offer a most appropriate question. A wife of noble character, who can find? She is worth more than rubies. So who can find the kind of woman that's here described? Who knows someone that measures up to this description of supermom? There's an author named Susan Yates who has a recently released book that's entitled And Then I Had Kids. And she says in that book, there are no supermoms. There's no such animal. If there is, she's lying. Which raises the question of who wrote this anyway, Proverbs 31. Now, someone over here suggests that it was a 26-year-old single male, and he is writing out a job description of his future spouse. And someone over here has quite a different theory and thinks that it's a copywriter for Hallmark cards cranking up for next year's Mother's Day. Well, frankly, I've got to tell you that there are a lot of women, a lot of mothers, who can become more discouraged than encouraged by the description of this noble woman of Proverbs chapter 31. That's because they are struggling with balancing careers and marriage and home and personal life. Or maybe they feel guilty about not having children, or perhaps they're staying at home with their children and they have a lot of subtle and sometimes not so subtle pressures from other people that say, why aren't you in the workplace the way other people are in the workplace? Or they're single moms who have no husband to give them praise and wince at verse 28. Such scripture can be very tough on maybe 100% of the Christian women who don't quite measure up to what seems to here be the biblical standard of the way a woman is to be. I invite you to especially focus in on that 28th verse, which says that her children arise and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Here we discover that the core of this description is not our modern supermom syndrome, but that the core is being a praiseworthy woman. The essence is not what time she gets up or when she goes to bed, what she gets for real estate or whether she has a vineyard or stitches the clothes or any of the things that are here described about her circumstances, but that she's praiseworthy for her character, not for her circumstance. This woman of Proverbs 31 had a very unusual set of circumstances, and you who do not have servant girls say indeed she did, but she did even for ancient days. Most women then did not have all of these things that she had. And you say, well, you know, with a few good servants and good looks and money and a super husband, anybody could show that kind of good character. Could they? That is so obviously not true that it's hardly worth comment. For every generation is strewn with the broken biographies of people who had marvelous circumstances handed to them sometimes almost literally on the proverbial silver platter. And because they lacked character and because they lacked godliness, they wrecked their lives, even though they had as much as this woman had or more. There's an old saying that it takes a steady hand to hold a full cup. Let me tell you that it takes a strong character to handle the great prosperity that this woman experienced in Proverbs 31. The reason her children and her husband praise her is because of her character. Not her real estate, not the deals she made, not the cooking that she did, not the late hours that she kept. Verse 10 is right. A woman of noble character, who can find? She is worth far more than rubies. Character. Character is that combination of internal qualities and convictions which are right and which are good. It's a goodness on the inside that controls and that directs the response to the circumstances that are on the outside. She was a woman of character, controlled by that character, not by circumstance. But we're also told here in verse 30, that to character ought be added godliness. She is a woman who fears the Lord. So she is more concerned about what God thinks than about what anybody else thinks. And they may praise her at the city gate, and her husband may think that she is wonderful. And her children might rise up to call her blessed, but she is most attuned in her listening to what God thinks about her. For God is by far the most important person in her life. I'm convinced that this woman would walk away from it all. She would give up that which she owns and the comforts which she has. And I believe that she would give up her children and her husband if God called her to do so. Because God is so clearly the most important person in her life. Interestingly, there are lots of stories in the Bible of women, some of whom had wonderful circumstances, some of whom did not, some of whom were persons of character and godliness, and others who were not. Any list of the women of Scripture must begin with Eve, and if anyone ever had it all, she had it all. She did have a perfect husband, absolutely a perfect husband in Adam, and she lived in paradise, complete paradise, where all the pleasures were there. And you know, she spent at least a part of every day literally walking with God. She communed with him. She heard him speak to her directly, and she answered him back. If ever anyone had it all, it was Eve. And because of the choices she made, she forsook good character and godliness and chose instead sin. Or read on in the scripture to the biography of Ruth, a woman after whom one of the books of the Bible is named. She was a woman, if you recall her story, who had a heathen heritage. She did not walk with God. She didn't know much about God at all. She grew up in raw paganism. She married a man who soon died, and so she was quite young, a widow. The circumstances of life were rotten to her. She knew very little about this God of her husband, and it would seem, at least circumstantially, that this God of her husband had not treated him nor her very well. But she was a woman of character and a woman of godliness. And so she turned her back upon her heathenism. She chose not to become bitter by her widowhood, but instead demonstrated herself to be a woman of character and of godliness. Or read the biography of Hannah, a woman who struggled with infertility, and her friends and those around her were having children, and it was an anguish in her soul. And so when the Bible first introduces us to her, she is crying, weeping in agony because she has no child. But she's also praying. And as she prays and as she weeps, God extraordinarily intervenes. I don't know why, for her and not for others who have similarly wept and prayed. But God gave to her a child, an extraordinary son named Samuel. But then, at an age that I'm sure she counted to be far too young, God chose to take that child back away from her. And when God gave her the child, she rejoiced. And when God took the child away, she surrendered him back. Because Hannah was a woman of character and a woman of godliness. Or let me tell you the story of a woman who I think has as much or more told about her as any woman in the Old Testament, and yet whose name is not very well known probably to many of us. Her name was Gomer. Gomer is a main character of the Bible. She had a husband who is far better known to most of us, a husband really who was, I think, a better man than this man described here in Proverbs 31:23. His name was Hosea. He was a great, great prophet of God. In fact, one of the Old Testament books is named after him. Gomer and Hosea married, and God blessed them with three children, two sons, one named Jezreel, the other named Lo-Ami, and a daughter named Lo-Ruhamah. Gomer, somewhat like Eve, had it all. I mean, she had it all. And she walked right out of the house to crawl into bed with another man. And she broke her husband's heart. But let me tell you what kind of a husband she had. He followed after. He tracked her down and he banged on the door and he went in and he got her and he put a blanket over her shoulders and forgave her and brought her home. And she did it again. Not with the same man, but with another man. And her husband forgave her again and he tracked her down and he brought her home. And the book of Hosea is chapter after chapter after chapter of the story of Gomer walking away from that kind of husband and those children and those wonderful circumstances in order to have her illicit sexual affairs with all the men of the community. Because she wasn't a woman of character, nor a woman of godliness. And of course, the list ought to include Mary. Mary, whom we lift up as a marvelous example, and rightly so. But remember that she was a somewhat unwilling mother at the beginning, one who ended up nearly in divorce before she was even married, but through it all, and her circumstances were far from easy, she repeatedly demonstrated herself to be, like the woman of Proverbs 31, a person of character and of godliness. Now, all of this is to say that what makes a woman praiseworthy is not perfection. So don't read this chapter this way. What makes her praiseworthy is character and godliness, no matter what the circumstances. Now, all of that having been said, it seems to me that it raises two pressing questions, particularly for Mother's Day. It raises first the question, what if I'm not like this? What if it's not a matter of circumstance, but what if I am not a woman, a person of character and of godliness? What then about me? Or it raises the second question, what if I am not perfect, but one of righteous character and one of godly commitment? And what if, in spite of my character and godliness, my children do not rise up and call me blessed, nor does my husband give me praise? What then shall I do? Let me seek to give short, straightforward answers to those questions. To question number one, what if I am not like this? The short and straightforward answer is to become like that. To become a woman of character and of godliness. For the Bible is the repeated story, not of all of these people so much as their God. And he is a God of beginning again. He is the God of fresh starts. He is the God who takes people in all of their inadequacy and all of their sin and welcomes them to Jesus Christ, where in Jesus Christ they find forgiveness of that sin and salvation which turns unrighteous people into righteous persons. And it becomes then a matter of choice for Jesus and a choice thereafter to live in terms of character and godliness. So if the question is, what if I'm not like that? It is through Jesus Christ to become like that. And to the second question, what if I am a person of character and godliness? My children do not rise up to call me blessed, nor does my husband praise me. Then to you, the straightforward and simple answer is to await the guaranteed praise, the absolute delight that God will give you for the rest of eternity. But I think those questions are better answered not with a short and straightforward reply, but rather with a story, a true story. The name's not changed. The story of Monica, who was born into a Christian home, marvelous family, fine parents, who from the time of her birth instructed her in the truths of Scripture and developed her every way they could to be a godly woman. But when she was about 20 years old, she did something that she clearly had been instructed not to do, something she knew to be contrary to the Scripture. It was a sin, and for the rest of her life, she lived with the consequence of that sin. For when she was 20 years old, she married a man named Pat, who was not a Christian. He was a raw pagan. He was a man of loose morals. He was unfaithful to her from the time of their marriage and before, and through the rest of his life. He was a man who had a fiery temper, and she lived with that and with the reputation. It was an enormous mistake, and she had a bad marriage. They lived together in the town of Tagaste, which is a small community, where although he had all the things that he had, he nevertheless was reckoned to be something of a success and was elected many times to the city council. They had two children, two sons, one daughter. Monica did her very best to raise her children as she had been raised. And so she taught them the truths of Scripture. She told them the stories of the Bible. She disciplined them in the ways of the Christian life. She and she alone, for her husband did not agree with this, she alone poured everything she possibly could for good into the lives of her children. Her younger son and her daughter, from the earliest age, responded marvelously well and walked with God all their lives. But her oldest son, named Gus, while he superficially responded well in childhood, as he grew into adolescence, rejected more and more the teaching that his mother had given to him. Gus was an interesting guy. He had the fiery temperament of his father. But he was bright. He was bright, and he was articulate. At first, he did very well in school, although as he reached high school, he had no interest whatsoever in school and failed to do anything whatsoever in his studies. All he cared about doing was play. Except, and this says something about the kind of person that Gus was, when he played, he had to win. And he soon developed a reputation that he always lied and cheated. When he finally got interested enough in high school and in his studies, he was 17. And he was put into then a private school. His father, although not a man of great means, was able through his work to come up with payments for the tuition, and so he did, and he paid for Gus to go to that private school. Except it was that year that Gus's father, Pat, died. And so just when it appeared that he would have to drop out of that private school when it seemed like he might be catching up in his schoolwork, a benevolent gentleman in the city of Tagaste offered to pay the tuition. And that was really the beginning of the catching up on Gus's education, and he ended up with a pretty good education. Became especially interested in the classics and became something of an expert in the Latin and Greek writings and languages. But morally, don't think he changed, for when he was 18, he had a girlfriend and he moved in with her and they lived together. She became pregnant, and to her was born a son. A son whom Gus decided he would name in accordance with his studies in the classics, and in what I assure you was only a fleeting moment of seeming spirituality. He named him Adiodatus, which means by God given, but think not that he had turned around spiritually, for he had not. He lived with her, his girlfriend, for 13 years thereafter. They never married. And that was heavy on the heart of Monica's mother. And the rest of the story is really, really too long to tell. Gus did well in classical studies, got a good education, and then did develop a spiritual interest in his life, but not in Orthodox Christianity. Rather, he became a fervent adherent of a terrible cult. In fact, he traveled around as an evangelist for that cult. And because he was so bright and because he was so articulate, he was very successful in persuading other people to become adherents to the heretical way that he had followed. And over a period of 10 years, he increasingly rose up almost to the top of the hierarchy of that cult, which was by then becoming a worldwide phenomenon. Except what I'm really telling you is Monica's story. Through all this, she prayed for him. But he did not rise up and call her blessed. And her husband, never in his life, spoke to her a word of praise. Her son, in fact, would trick her. He would lie to her to somehow give the impression that maybe he had changed his ways. On one special occasion, he told her that he would come home, that he would do what he was supposed to do. And she was delighted, and she went to pray in a special chapel near the shore. And while she was praying, he sneaked away and broke his promise, boarded a ship, and left so she couldn't know where he was or find him. The good news is that when Gus was 33 years old, he turned to Jesus Christ. And he became a Christian. And Monica was, by then, 55. To say that she was thrilled is an inadequate description. She moved from one continent to another in order to be near him. It was the next summer that they vacationed together at the seashore. And one day, she said some words that he remembered, in fact, recorded. I'll not tell you them all, but simply, she said, "Son, what has befallen me? For there seems to be a change. I had lived but for one thing, and that was that you become a Christian. And now you have." She said, "God has richly granted me this beyond measure. In permitting me to see you in his service, you've totally abandoned the world." And she wondered out loud if there was anything yet for her to live for. When she spoke those words to him, she was in good health, but just a few days later, she became desperately ill, and she died. Now, you know that her circumstances were obviously not the same as this amazing woman of Proverbs chapter 31. But let me tell you that they were both women of godliness and of character. And let us understand that it is not the painful or the pleasant circumstances of life which make a woman worthy to be praised or to be called blessed. It is, again, her character and her godliness. Now let me tell you the epilogue to Monica's story. But what I tell you, she did not live to know. Her son, Augustine, became a pastor, a bishop, a writer, a theologian, a saint. In fact, the historians of the Christian church will often say that two men, more than any others, shaped the direction of Christianity for all of history. And those two men were St. Paul and St. Augustine. In fact, it is our Florida city of St. Augustine that is named after him. She was a woman of character. She was a woman of God. And so may you be. May you be modern Monicas. May your children rise up and call you blessed. And may your husband also praise you. But most of all, may Jesus Christ himself someday say, "Well done, good and faithful woman."